Hello, welcome to the Lately in JavaScript podcast. I'm Manuel Amuser, always the host of the this show. And also always I have here with me Michael Kimsel, and that also has came for this episode, which is number 13. Hello, Michael.
Good morning.
New special effects.
That was my soundboard. Good morning.
How are you doing? I suppose you are quite fine.
I'm doing excellent.
Yeah, that's what I can see. Well, today we have a guest in the show, Dimo Gambone, and he also is a contributor of the JS Classes site, as well of JS Mag magazine.
Yeah.
Hello, Dino. How are you doing?
Hello, everyone. Pleasure to be with you guys today.
So, and, Dino, where are you coming in from? Where are you based?
All right. So, I am located outside of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, in a nice little suburban area north of Philadelphia. I'm currently a manager of web development services for the company I work for, which basically what my team does, we develop revenue and high visibility web apps for our clients. So when they have something that needs to be really cool, a big complex problem for other people to solve, they usually come to my team. And, you know, with a lot of JavaScript, HTML, and some ASP.NET, we usually hit it out of the park.
And what are you wearing?
But actually, I'm still in my work outfit, so I'm wearing my dress shirt and pants.
Okay, there you go. You got it right from the horse's mouth. So, Manuel, it's your turn to ask a question.
Yeah, that was a quite relevant question. Well,
it's all in how you say it, because I could have said, "Hey, Dino, what are you wearing?"
I'm glad you didn't.
Yeah. Okay. So back to you, Manuel.
Well, Dino, you have been, as I mentioned, a contributor. Actually, you just started being a contributor of the JS Classes site and wrote some articles to the JS magazine.
I just happened to find through listening to Lately in JavaScript.
Awesome.
Yeah, and what I was wondering if you could comment a bit more about what you do related to the JavaScript world that motivates you to also write these classes and articles that you are putting out.
Well, what, like I mentioned, I am the manager of web development. So most of the work we do is web-based. So it's usually either web services or websites. When it comes to the websites, it's really heavy HTML5 or HTML and JavaScript, jQuery, Ajax, anything that we can really offload onto the client. Basically, we've moved to a model that is put as much work on the client, distribute as much of the workload to the client as possible, using Ajax just to get the data back and forth. So a lot of our web apps are very JavaScript heavy just because of the amount of power JavaScript's got lately, with, you know, the emergence of Chrome and Firefox really pushing the envelope on JavaScript speed, and, you know, IE finally getting off their butts and, you know, kind of picking it up a little. They're still in last, but, you know, at least they're you know, moving in the right direction. And then you got the iPad and iPhone, which with the iOS Safari browser is actually a really nice platform for web development. So, you know, everything we do, we're really targeting HTML and JavaScript front end. And that's the vast majority of the work that goes into our project is on that front end. As far as what drives me to do what I do with Michael and I actually started writing a blog, it's my passion. I love writing code. You know, I've been doing web development for over 15 years. That means I've written websites for Netscape 4 and IE3 was when I first started out, and that's what we were dealing with. And unfortunately, back then, you didn't really have as much compatibility between the browsers as you do now, which is a little scary if you think about it. So it's always something I really just love doing. I've always told, you know, the higher ups in the company, if you give me a project and you ask me which is the better approach, desktop or web, for developing a project, I'm going to tell you 9 times out of 10, it's going to be a website, because there's absolutely very little that I can't do on a web application using just HTML and JavaScript that I could do on a desktop. And really, with HTML5, I think that's almost even gone down to nothing.
Yeah, that certainly has changed. I think those of us that have been in the web world have always liked web apps. And you'd like to say, well, the web is always the best choice because it's distributed, because centralized security, whatever it may be. But there's always been a lot of things that you couldn't easily do. Even things like drag and drop file upload.
And that's the one thing that always, you know, I always ask them up front.
Yeah.
Do you need to do anything with files? If you don't, we're doing that as a web app.
Yeah. But I think as we, you mentioned HTML5, as we get more progress with future standards, as we get more capable browsers, things like offline storage, local databases, you know, the last few years we've seen a lot of work, you know, earlier with Google Gears, and then offline storage, local queryability, all those sorts of things that seemed like you had to use a desktop app for those things 10 years ago, and mm-hmm. you don't have to now. There may still be legitimate reasons, whether it's security or distribution. You know, there are certainly still some reasons to write traditional fat desktop client apps, but the technology of the web, the browser, and what you can do locally has, in some ways, it doesn't feel that radical, but you go back 15 years. Mine go back to the mid-90s as well. And if you were to think about what we can do now, what we take for granted as commonplace now, it has been pretty radical. It just, I don't think it's really felt like it year to year so much.
No, somebody who's really started in the 2000s really doesn't have that background of what you were really limited to back in the late 90s and even early 2000s with, you know, even JavaScript was so different between IE and Netscape. And then, you know, once Netscape kind of died off, it was really just IE. But, you know, there was always there, you know, those weird pieces of JavaScript until you had Firefox come on the scene and really just, you know, explode, you know, the browser war again. Everything just really went nuts. You know, around 2005, Google jumped in, and you know, of course, you always had Apple in play there. But once that kind of got rolling, JavaScript just really matured. I mean, it's just amazing with ECMAScript 5, and you know, just all the things that have changed even in just the past 2 years. You know, and like you mentioned, the web database thing for offline storage, AJAX.
Yep.
You know, people don't realize. One, AJAX is a Microsoft invention, so you know, Microsoft did contribute stuff to it. And two, you know, it really wasn't used heavily until more recently when people have really incorporated into all the browsers. And now you have the whole, well, all right, we have WebSockets because, you know, AJAX was great for getting real-time information from the sending it to the server and getting a response. But, you know, you don't always want to ping the server. You want to get that push message back to the client. WebSockets fills that void. You know, there's workarounds in the past, but nothing beats a true native implementation.
Well, now that you're bringing up push, I have visions of the 3-inch large Netscape push book with the green spine from 1996. what goes around comes around. What is old again is new again. Long polling. I'm thinking point cast. That's the other thing I was thinking of. Oh, it's push technology. No, it's really just long poll. But that's a whole other kettle of fish, which I think, you know, some of us have, Manuel and I have kind of beat that to death in the past a bit. And you're welcome to beat the corpse a little more. But it's just in some ways, those of us that have been doing this, I know Manuel's been doing this for, what, 12, 15 years or so with web stuff. You've been around for a long time. It does feel like we're seeing a resurgence of ideas that were popular 10, 15 years ago. JSON is another, not that that's a repeated idea, but that has been another construct that has evolved or come about in the past few years. I think that was Ward Cunningham developed the idea behind that and made it very straightforward and simple. It's native to JavaScript, and that has really exploded and made it just an expected way for people to exchange data. None of this XML schemas and all that. It's just, here's a block of data, unserialize it, and you're good to go.
It's simple, and it makes sense to anyone dealing with the language. Yep. And how just if you look at it, how amazing is it that there's all these features of JavaScript in there that were never planned to be in there. They just kind of, if you do this and this, you all of a sudden have this brand new, delivery platform just because it's built into the language. You never expected it. It was never written for that. It just happened to be there, just sprung out of nowhere.
Well, and a lot of the patterns that we're seeing emerge, best practices, both in frameworks like jQuery and Dojo and things like that, and just best practices that people suggest for JavaScript now, a lot of them are ideas that were around many, many years ago, and it's felt to me like maybe only in the past 3 to 5 years that people have been giving serious software architecture thought to JavaScript. I think as the dominance of IE has gone away, we've seen the rise, and I don't know if it's causal or if they're just if they just happen to occur at the same time. But we've got this rise of your Firefox, Safari, Chrome, maybe to some extent Opera, but they largely have very compatible JavaScript and DOM engines, more similar than different. And IE has historically been the odd man out there. Whatever standards they may support, it just has typically not been at a JavaScript compatible level. So as the others have together become, if not a majority, at least a large minority block that can work with the same JavaScript code, we've seen more advances not in the JavaScript engines necessarily, though we've seen SpiderMonkey and things like that, with speed increases, but we've seen a development in people taking it seriously. And it's easier to take it seriously if instead of, well, I'm gonna write great JavaScript code, but it's only going to work on Netscape 3, and I can't get it even to work on Netscape 4, because we've seen maturation and we've seen this consolidation, it's easier to say, I'm going to spend more time on it because this is going to be long-lived. It's going to be in a long-lived project, and it's going to run on multiple platforms. Anyway, I've just ranted there a little too much, but I think, as you're saying, these things weren't necessarily designed in, but like many good languages, they can be flexible enough to have good practices applied to them, and they fit.
Yeah.
There you go.
I have actually a question. It is related with an object that Dino sent to the site. We'll get back to that object later, but my question is related to what you do. You mentioned you work in web development, but from what I could see in this object, it seems to be more for games or probably other 2D applications. Are you working also on games and JavaScript or something related?
I do. If anyone's read the articles that I've written for JS Mag, they will see that all my articles are very heavy game background. Game development is something I've done on the side since, I've been in college when I first started playing with MUDs, which are basically text-based games that ran on a giant Unix system, just text-based. And it's more kind of like the Zork-type games where you say go east, go west, kill rat, things like that.
Good old Zork, yeah.
Yep. So that's really, it's always been a passion of mine is game development and building, I'm not looking to build the next World of Warcraft or the next Modern Warfare. I just want to build something that people enjoy, and you know what? If it gets great reviews, fine. It's just something I love doing personally.
So that's a hobby, right? Or something related with your actual work?
Yeah, unfortunately, you can't make, unless you're in the right position, you can't really make a great career out of game development right now. So my professional job is actually in more of the pharma medical field. And data analytics. That's where I'm currently employed right now. I've been doing game development for quite some time, but it's never been an official production release of any game at this point. There's articles you can do a search online for various different articles I've written pre JavaScript and JSMag, and most of them are going to be located on gamedev.net, talking about just different fundamentals of isometric-based games, things like that. I've helped contribute to the community in that whole isometric field. Isometric is that, I don't know if anyone played Diablo back in the mid to late 90s, that kind of their, 45-degree view down onto the character, that's isometric. So, before 3D graphics was really prominent, people wanted to have 3D-like feel, so they did isometric, which is basically 2D tiles kind of arranged slightly differently.
Okay, well, we'll get back to that topic ahead when we talk about the latest objects published in the JS Classes site. And we'll have the chance to talk a bit more about those games and or otherwise 2D or 3D related applications based on JavaScript. But right now we are going to move on with our podcast. We have several interesting topics, some somehow related with JavaScript, either directly or indirectly. And I'm going to start from this recent news from Adobe that they are ceasing the development of the Flash plugin for mobile browsers. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I also saw this site, Occupy Flash. It seems there is a great trend to occupy everything now. And this OccupyFlash.org site is basically yet another attempt to exercise some pressure to make Flash use in web mainly, cease permanently, because nowadays we have technologies built-in browsers using JavaScript that allow us to implement similar capabilities to those that were provided by Flash. Did you guys see this site and also follow the news about the Adobe initiative? What did you think?
Dino. Michael?
All right.
I'll go first.
I'll go first. Steve Jobs had it right, I guess. When he released the iPhone, he was like, no Flash because it's big, it's bloated, buggy, it's slow. The web is going to evolve to the point where you don't need Flash anymore. 4 years later, it's almost there. I mean, there's really nothing that Flash does that you can't do with a little bit of JavaScript, CSS, and HTML5. And in fact, Adobe even has I forget what they call it, some sort of server package that will actually convert their Flash code into HTML and JavaScript. So, I mean, they've really kind of, at this point, thrown in the towel. And it's kind of nice that, I don't want to say that Flash is going away. It served a great purpose in the early 2000s when this wasn't possible with JavaScript. But it's nice that it's not going to be around anymore for people to kind of get stuck with having to always, I can't go to this site because I'm on my iPhone or iPad and it uses Flash only. And, my company doesn't like Flash videos coming through, which does happen often. So it's about time. Thanks to Flash for all they've done. But like every technology that we've worked on in the past, it eventually grows old and needs to be replaced with something else. And it's about time to happen. So probably another 2-3 years, you're not going to hear Flash mentioned anymore, just because all the browsers will be up to HTML5 and 6 or 7, which is they're out by then. Video streaming will be supported natively. JavaScript will just be so rampant everywhere that you can pause and start streams of video and pull in new music, move objects around. Flash has outlived its purpose.
But how do you really feel?
I'm going to miss it. I'm going to cry. No. in all reality, was this really a shock to anyone?
I would say it was a shock to me, not that it happened, but maybe at the time the timing that it did happen. I always expect things to happen, things like that, that larger companies will hold on a bit longer. But
I will give Adobe credit for seeing the writing on the wall and not really trying to keep it on life support, because there is no way Flash could win in this battle between HTML5 and Flash. It's just impossible. Too many people are gung-ho about getting to HTML5 and removing Flash. I'm actually surprised there's not a JavaScript library out there already that converts ActionScript into JavaScript other than what Adobe offers.
Yeah.
Well, what I wonder is that if all that Flash can do can already be done in JavaScript in all browsers. For instance, recording audio, recording video.
Yeah, all this stuff can't. It's not 100% replaceable at this point.
So I sort of agree with Michael. It's probably not yet the right time to do that. On the other hand, it's also worth noticing that this news from Adobe is that they are only ceasing the development of the mobile plugin.
They're ceasing development mobile of the browser. Player, correct? It's not just Flash complete, it's the player.
No, it's just for mobile browsers. They'll continue on the desktop. Actually, I just received a new version, at least for Linux. Not that I want
to get a new version.
The new version is just that it appeared in the update. And, as much as we would like to make Flash obsolete, the question is it really totally obsolete already?
Let me ask you this question. You mentioned recording the audio and the video through Flash. Do you use Flash to record your audio and video?
I don't work in that area, but people that do, they complain about that.
Well, things like Justin TV, there's some others. There's a podcast service that lets people call in and do stuff. It's over the phone, but you can also have people contribute over Flash. But the streaming cams, hey, you know, all the sex cams out there, what are they going to do? I didn't actually bring that up,
But those probably don't use the mobile.
For
recording, because playback can be done with other means, not.
Okay.
I mean, you think about the recording piece. If I was someone who needs to record audio, video, you know, Flash is one of the last of my choices. Now, I've seen, I think Livestream has like a studio that, or no, Procaster, that's who it is. Procaster has a studio that it is Flash-based, and you can kind of do a little bit of video streaming management, you know, tools, things like that. And that is Flash-based. But they also have a native desktop app that does it.
Yeah, if you can install the native app, but if you want to distribute your recording ability or your streaming ability to say anybody on these devices, anybody on just install this plugin. I did streaming stuff a few years ago, and we ended up using Windows Media for everything because the Flash stuff. While I could build a Flash thing, the native encoder, video encoder, was just not good. Now Onto had an awesome Flash-based video encoder, a separate codec, but they charged you something like 50 cents a minute to encode, or per encoded minute. So we went back to Windows Media, which is good enough. But that was still, and you're going to have these Windows controls downloaded through your browser, and then you can stream up.
I guess because of worse.
Well, I mean, you could say, well, these are niche uses, but what we've been seeing over the past 2, 3, 4 years is that JavaScript in the browser has been largely marginalizing all the purported use cases for Flash. So, you know, every 6 months or a year, there's fewer requirements that this is the only way you can do this is in Flash. But until we see good audio support and good video support for creating, not just consuming, but for being a content creator, and until we see that from the browsers, Flash and probably Silverlight to some extent will be around for a while. What I am afraid may happen is that we'll end up with the same level of support for audio and video content creation in the browser as we ended up with Java on the client, which was a completely sorry state of just abandoned crap.
Yeah.
And I hope we don't see that. But in some case, I wonder what the incentive for, in some sense, nobody can tell me that between Mozilla, Apple, Google, Opera, whoever, they've never understood that anybody has any need to record audio and stream audio up to a server, or video. Like, that's just never crossed their mind. The combined engineering power of those companies and the pockets of those companies is massive. They massively outweigh Adobe. And yet none of them have, I won't even say they haven't made it a priority. They haven't even made it anything that they've even talked about, as far as I can tell. So, you know, as much as Adobe's been the whipping boy for everybody for a long time, they still are providing things that no one else even seems ready to touch. There I go. I said it.
Another related point to this discussion of JavaScript and Flash is that often I listen to people saying that JavaScript animations, applets are heavy, they hog the machines, they consume a lot of resources. But often when I see that happening in practice is because somebody decided to put a complex animation with all a lot of effects that do not cease, do not stop consuming resources from the user's machine. And I wonder if when people switch to same results using JavaScript, will it be as heavy as with Flash, or probably worse, or not? Because I don't see how JavaScript is going to make it better for complex animations than Flash. Have you thought about this?
Complex animations, how though? I mean, JavaScript
For instance, those advertising animations that once in a while you see a lot of graphics going around just to grab the attention of the user. And all that is consuming resources because you have to animate all those graphics that are in there. And sometimes they use heavy images that have to be processed during the animations. And all that consumes resources. What I'm afraid is that in the end it will be the same. If you try to do the same complex animations using JavaScript, it will still consume a lot of resources. So what I think is that people are trying to blame Flash for all these problems, but in the end the fault is on the people that create those Flash-based
I think we'll probably go through at least a period where it's harder to get rid of that, some of those things, because right now people can do ad block and say, well, let me just block any Flash. I want a Flash block. I don't want any Flash because I'm just going to see crap. Are we going to be able to develop a JavaScript block that just blocks all JavaScript?
There are solutions for blocking JavaScript. Actually, they probably will be able to block specific things that whoever defines what needs to be blocked has already studied to figure what is disturbing the user.
But now we're putting that into somebody else's hands instead of giving the end user control and saying, I want this, I don't want this. Now you're ceding control of your browsing experience. Hey, to
Google.
Well,
I was talking about ad blocking, not exactly the production of those content.
I understand. But somebody now is going to be define what is annoying JavaScript. Well, this JavaScript pattern of code probably is an ad, so let me block it instead of just blocking Flash or not. And I think it'll be harder to disable that sort of stuff. Well, I want to enable this. It's there's a lot of pros.
Right.
There's a lot of pros to Flash going away, but it's going to open a whole separate can of worms because the problem is not specifically Flash, which I think is what you're trying to say. It's the way that people use it and the way that people are going to use HTML or HTML JavaScript.
Right.
And that's going to, in a related note here, announcement last week, 2 weeks ago, Flex. Adobe is going to transition Flex over to the Apache Foundation, and they're basically washing their hands of Flex and saying, we're going to do HTML5 and JavaScript stuff in the future. Here's Flex, and somebody else is going to maintain it. The community will maintain it. Anybody that's chosen Flex in the past 6 months or a year, and probably is still developing stuff, they've tied themselves to a long-term loser, unfortunately.
Adobe still supporting Air?
I'm suspecting that they are for the time being, but it will not surprise me if in the next 6 months they make an announcement as soon as they have something that will replicate even maybe 50% of what the Air stuff does right now. They'll have a converter, and they'll say, convert all your stuff over to your Air stuff over to JavaScript, and it doesn't do these, but we'll work on it. And it's going to be messy for the Adobe stack for the next couple of years.
Actually, Air stuff is not solely based on Flash. It's also based on HTML and JavaScript. It's not something specific to Flash.
Right, but untangling that, somebody starting with an Adobe stack 6 months from now and they have some HTML tool and it's all great, it's going to be fine for them. But anybody that has current stuff that wants to transition it or keep maintaining it, it's going to get ugly, I think. Very, very painful.
Yeah. Well, good thing they have Photoshop, though. So.
Yes, except for Photoshop.
Okay. Well, I think there will be a lot more to say about this, and I'm sure we'll get back to these Flash versus pure JavaScript solutions in future shows.
Sure.
Because there's plenty to say about it. But moving on with our podcast.
Can I mention the next one on the list? Yeah.
Okay.
The Googlebot, now capable of executing JavaScript and indexing pages that have JavaScript. Now you have a comment here to say to index Facebook comments, and this is a link to a Matt Cutts post. Matt Cutts from Google, and it's been one of those perennial statements that SEO people have said, and Google or search engines don't index JavaScript or don't execute JavaScript, therefore they don't know what's on your page if it's all in JavaScript. And that seems, certainly with Google, they've been very public now saying that, no, that is not the case. It can execute JavaScript, and the results of that, the text results of those JavaScript can be indexed. How deep they're doing that across the board on all sites probably remains to be seen.
Well, I don't know yet what is the extent of this JavaScript support. What I read is this is somewhat related with Google versus Facebook competition.
Mm-hmm.
And because some time ago Facebook allowed people to sort of use Facebook as comments on blog posts, so you could have those comments embedded in the blog pages, but that embedding would be done in JavaScript. So actually, in the past, I have noticed that Google mentioned that could execute some JavaScript in the pages.
Mm-hmm.
But that was for quite simple situations. I'm not sure if they could do it to a greater extent. And now there seems to be this additional motivation because Google also wants to index the comments that are in blog posts.
Mm-hmm.
And using those embedded JavaScript widgets that make the comments appear there.
Discuss and so on, yeah.
Yeah, well, we don't know yet other situations that on which Google is actually executing the JavaScript on your pages. But I think the important thing to keep in mind is that if you, for some reason, are using JavaScript in your site pages, assuming that Google will never index it, you may think again it because it may not be true, probably already in the present, or at least in the future. And this is something to keep an eye on because I'll just give you a simple case on which I used JavaScript assuming that Google and other bots will not crawl it. I use JavaScript, for instance, to track clicks on links that I wanted to take some statistics of visitation. And what I did is to use JavaScript, and I think I need to review that approach and probably use something that does not depart from that assumption that search engines will not crawl your JavaScript. And this is just one thing somehow related with JavaScript, but now moving on to other more JavaScript-specific topics that interest more, I think, our listeners, starting with Script Cover, which is basically a Chrome extension that does code coverage. Well, I have never seen any code coverage solutions for JavaScript. And for me, this is news. And for those that are not familiar with code covering concepts, this basically is used to determine the extent of the code, JavaScript code that you are maybe using in your web pages.
Mm-hmm.
To evaluate whether your code has been fully tested or not. So this is related with quality control. And, I develop most of my stuff in PHP, and even in PHP I have not used anything related to code coverage, despite I reckoned its value. Did you guys have been using any code coverage in tools for any language?
Yeah, I've used some Xdebug in PHP. I've done some in Java before, and I've seen other people do it in with C# stuff. I haven't seen it for JavaScript. Have you seen this in JavaScript before, Dino?
I've seen. I'm trying to remember what the name of. There's a server-side version of a kind of almost a remote debugger that. Somewhat like this, but JavaScript on the client, it's so tough to build something that, you know, no one needs to really have to install a whole whole plugin or something to really test out code coverage. JavaScript is one of the times it's just really tough to debug in the client because you're now running inside of a separate process that you can't step through. I'm saying outside of the whole Firefox or Google developer tools or IE developer tools, there's no real way for a developer to really step through it. This does seem like it's going to be a nice tool to have to be able to, one, see, where is your code being hit? How often is it being hit? And, the one thing that I have to do with the client side stuff with my company is, you're going to be hitting, what's the rule? It's like 90% of the time you're running 10% of your code.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you can really optimize that 10%, and what this tool seems like it will help narrow down where that 10% is, you can really develop very responsive and rich front ends.
Yeah. No, I'm looking forward to doing a bit more with it. Probably December sometime. We have an interview. I'm not sure how extended the interview will be, but we have an interview with the Script Cover team, such as they are, coming up in next month's JS Mag. So I haven't seen the final thing yet, but I'm hoping that that there's something interesting in there beyond just what they've put in their blog post so far. Because the last blog post I saw from them was end of October, and I don't know how much more progress they've done so far.
Yeah, this is a Google project, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we'll keep an eye on this because it's certainly very interesting, especially those that are more focused on test-driven development.
Sure.
Moving on with our podcast, another JavaScript library that I have found out to be very interesting is Timeline.js. Which is basically an animation library, like many others, except that it provides a GUI-based timeline editor on which you can see different objects that you are animating and how and when they appear in the whole animation timeline. This sort of reminds me of the way that web designers use the Flash tools for putting together their animations and showing just to give a good idea of how it is going to appear, and makes the process of editing animations quite fast to do, and very easy to see what you are doing. Have you guys checked that this is a library? What do you think about it?
I was playing around with the I still am playing around with the demo that they have on the website. It's very Premiere like. If anyone's ever done any video management, it's got that same kind of feel. And I really love when people put together demos that are just this rich in UI. I mean, it's just, I've been playing around with it for the past hour, you know, adding new breakpoints, and it looks interesting. I'm not sure exactly where I would use it, but I'm sure there's plenty of people who would look at this and this would fit a specific need. Even the author said he had a specific need. And one of the nice benefits of this, which the author does point out, is whenever you're doing any JavaScript development, you basically have to write it, bring up the browser, see that it doesn't work because it never works the right first time, go back to the editor, change it, hit refresh, go back to the editor, change it, hit refresh, and go that back and forth. Where the way he put this together is, you know, it's basically all stored on a local storage, and you know, you do it all kind of right then and there, and it kind of just cycles and loops through the animation. So you can see your changes without actually having to go and refresh and go back to an editor and refresh. Very, very cool. Cool.
Yeah. Right. Now, I think this editor, this GUI-based editor, is not meant to be used in production animation. It's just for editing. And,
no, it is. And he has on the demo, there's a button that you click on. It actually then gives you all the JavaScript code needed to complete the animation. But really what the tool does is helps you define your animation ahead of time and then pop it into wherever you need to put it. My only concern about it is his requirement is that it requires Canvas. Not really a huge deal, except for everyone who's running IE8.
Yeah.
Then again,
probably just for the editor.
Yeah. Anyone listening to this podcast probably doesn't use IE8.
Yeah. But it's a concern, but it's probably a somewhat short-lived one. Certainly, this would be something to use for internal or intranet sort of apps. Being able to write something like this and use this, or you know, this is something I'm sure will be improved over time. There'll be more features at some point, more compatibility. A year from now, more people use an IE9, and that concern goes away, or is lessened. But you can never be 100% compatible. But hopefully, we'll start seeing more rapid iteration from the IE team as well, too.
Yeah. Right, but probably it's not that much of a concern because I didn't check the library, but I assume there's probably a part that is for editing and a part for runtime, I mean, to execute the actual animations. And that part probably does not need the canvas. Because unless there is some animation effect that relies on the use of a canvas object, I don't know, but that's a reasonable assumption, I suppose. Anyway, moving on with our podcast, now we are reaching the end. It's time to comment on the latest objects that have been published in JS Classes site. But first, I would like to comment briefly about a development that was done in JS Classes site and also in the PHP Classes site, because both sites share the same code base. And what was just released is the support for importing packages from Git repositories. So this concerns mainly the authors of packages, classes, libraries that are published in these sites. And this year I start adding support for this because some authors have very large packages, and using the traditional method of uploading each file one at a time would be quite painful. I can talk about it myself because I have submitted a lot of packages. I have the patience to submit them one file at a time. And now, this year it was introduced to the support to import packages from version control repositories. It started with CVS and then Subversion and now Git. Git and also Subversion are quite popular these days. Git is growing a lot in popularity. I think mainly due to the popularity of GitHub that made it very easy, and people, developers, liked it a lot to keep their development in there because it is easy to share and for others to fork, thanks to the version control capabilities of Git. And now with this support to being able to import packages from Git repositories, not just GitHub, any other. There are just a few types of repositories that need some work to make it be able to import from them, but any Git repository will be fully supported. Anyway, the message that I want to give with this is just if you are a developer that has been willing to submit your packages to get greater exposure to your work in JS classes site and as well PHP classes site, now you can import your packages if you have them hosted in Git repositories.
Cool.
Now actually you will be talking about the latest classes that we've been seeing on the JS classes site. What do you guys like to comment about? Oh, I remember Dino has his own class that we actually mentioned.
Sure. Well, there's two that I want to give a shout out to. One is Michel Andrioli from Italy, and he put together a corner detector class, which it's a jQuery plugin, so you need jQuery. It just works on top of that, on top of that. And this gives you the ability to return coordinates from or to detect if one element is inside of another. It will tell if the coordinates are inside the boundary of another one or not. Also lets you move stuff around. And then also, funnily enough, Timer, which I don't know if we talked about last month or not, but I'm in the market for a Timer class for a particular project, and was searching around and came on this one, and then thought I'd mention it today. This is Jeff Martin from the United States. Always got to give a shout out to people from the U.S. So carry on.
Well, you now it's time for you, Dino, to comment a bit about your
spatial
class.
Yes.
All right. Well, this class is from let me see if I pronounce his name right. Dino Gambone. Yep, that's it.
Yep.
He's from the United States. Look at that.
Oh, that's great.
But what the spatial hash is in typical 2D games, you have objects flying around everywhere, you have thousands of them, and basically when you need to figure out, am I colliding, the player colliding with any other object, you need a quick way of basically iterating through, the multitude of objects in the world and figure out, okay, these are the guys I'm actually colliding with, if any. The idea of the spatial hash is you basically create these buckets, and a bucket can be of, a certain size. You pick the size. So let's just, per se, you have a, 1,000 by 1,000 pixel world, and you create buckets of 100 pixels. So you basically, when an object moves, it gets placed into a bucket. If it happens just to cross boundaries of one bucket, it just gets placed in two buckets. The idea is that I only now need to worry about buckets that I'm in and not have to check every object in the world. Now, a couple of people asked for a demo. Michael Schultz and Carl Bailey both asked for demos. I will provide a demo. It's actually, this class is actually being used in the next article for JS Mag that I'm writing, which is a part two. But I'll leave that up to Michael to introduce.
Oh. Yeah. I think I mentioned your magazine, right? Well, I think we'll talk ahead a bit about it. On my part, I'll just like to comment just a few other classes very briefly. As always, we keep having great contributions from Heart Assassins from Latvia. This time is sent several of them, but I would like to highlight in particular this light source class. Actually, it was published right in the end of last month, but I think we did not comment it then. But basically what this does is to emulate a sort of a light that is applied on the elements of a page. So when there is a light on solid elements, there is some shadow. So this object uses some CSS properties to make the shadow be projected to a certain distance depending on the position of the light. And this provides a quite awesome effect that is very impressive to see. And I strongly recommend everybody to take a look specifically at this object. We had other objects also. There's also team metrics from also from Art Assassins that is basically meant to manipulate transformation matrices of web page elements that basically define how the elements and the page can be rotated or skewed or scaled. And this is also concerns the CSS 3, I think. The latest elements, the latest properties that were introduced with that CSS version. Other than that, we also had another object from Art Assassins, the text pen, which basically is a very simple way to obtain that effect of automatically expanding the area of text area input while the user is typing stuff inside of it. And
a very neat feature indeed. If you ever do web any sort of form development and you have text area, you definitely need that kind of functionality. Yeah.
Well, for those that are used to frequent Facebook, every time you enter a comment, not just Facebook, other social networks and other types of sites, that's the effect that you can see when you type stuff on your comment. And as your comment grows, it starts to expanding. And in this case, this object that Artus developed also is able to shrink back when, for some reason, you delete stuff and your text becomes smaller. There are also other interesting objects. Unfortunately, we do not have much time to comment about them, but I just mentioned them. There is the cookie object from Marco Schulz. I hope I'm pronouncing his name right. It's just basically to set and get cookie values. And I'm not sure if we have covered all of them.
Emran Ahmed, jQuery on the fly form validator. Thank you, Emran.
Yeah. Yes, this I was checking the submission date because there are other form validation components. I was afraid to be confusing them, but that's true. Emran also submitted this component this month.
Yep.
And Emran is from Bangladesh, and I think we have covered, at least mentioned, most of the components that were submitted recently.
Yep.
Now practically at the end of the podcast, Michael, can you please comment a bit about your articles of sure. your JS Mag magazine for sure. upcoming
yeah.
month.
Yeah, December. Looks like we will have Mike Schwartz is continuing his exploration of server-side JavaScript. I mentioned we have an interview with the script cover team, which that should be coming up. Also, Trevor Burnham, who actually wrote the book on CoffeeScript, has contributed a piece on CoffeeScript and testing for us. David Calhoun should have our standard news roundup, and potentially Dino Gambone, his second part two of his offline web app series. Dino, can I get you to commit on air?
Yes, I will have something available for you for December 2011.
Sweet. Kelly will be happy to hear that, too. So,
Kelly so, just loved it when I just sent it to him last minute, too.
He loves last minute. I shouldn't say that out loud. But that looks like, potentially, actually a guy in the Raleigh, moved to Raleigh area, named George Jempty. We've been kind of going back and forth. Well, he's pitched an idea, and we've started talking about it, but he's got a, it might be a two-part series on closures in JavaScript, but I'm not sure if we'll have that for December or if that'll be 2012 January.
Well, I think you'll have time because the world is only supposed to end in December 2012.
We got time, yeah.
So you still have time for a dozen issues, I suppose.
Thank you so much.
Well, okay. Unfortunately, our time has ended. It was yet another great podcast. We cover very interesting JavaScript-related topics. I'd like to thank Dino for coming and also add his insights to the show, as well Michael, as always.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
And on my part, thank you for listening. And keep sending your comments to the podcast. And for me, that's all for now.
Adios.
Good night.
Good night.